Once again to the Vancouver Institute. It's a great pleasure to see so many of you here tonight for a topic far different from the mundane concerns of the late 20th century that we've been hearing about for the last 4 or 5 weeks. Tonight we're going 2,400 years back in time with a man who is peculiarly well qualified to lead us back there. Professor Peter Green is one of the most eminent historians of the ancient Greek world in North America. He has been for nearly 25 years Doherty Professor of Classics at the University of Texas at Austin. Before that, he lived in Greece as a writer for 9 years. Before that, in England. He was educated at Charterhouse School and did his undergraduate and doctoral work at Cambridge University. After a number of years of wartime service in the Burma Command in India and the subcontinent, he came back to England, published his first book in 1952, and has continued to write steadily ever since. His most recent work is a translation of the poems of the Roman writer Ovid, the exile poems written from the Black Sea. Before that, he has translated as well Ovid's erotic poetry and the satires of the Roman writer Juvenal. He has translated extensively from works in Italian, French, and modern Greek, most recently completed a translation of the poet Yanis Ritsos. It's his classical work, however, that has earned him his well-deserved academic reputation. Books on the Athenian naval expedition to Sicily in 415, Armada from Athens, on the Persian defeat by the Athenians at Salamis in 480, a book called The Year of Salamis, a biography of Alexander the Great, and numerous books of essays and general books on Greek history and on detailed subjects like the Parthenon to bring Greek culture to the English-speaking world. He is well known as a lecturer and as a critic as well. He has been the literary critic for the London newspaper, the Daily Telegraph. He is a novelist. He's written 3 novels on ancient Greece and Rome, one a prize-winning one. Most recently, his novel on Sappho, The Laughter of Aphrodite, has been reprinted, and I notice is available in the Vancouver Public Library. I could go on at great length, but I think it would be better for you to hear from the man himself, ladies and gentlemen, Professor Peter Green.
After all that, tis us poor. What can I say? A recent Italian article asked in its title the not entirely rhetorical question, Egyptian Alexandria, a myth? Wisely, the writer omitted a main verb. If is evokes memories of Forster, Cavafy, and Durrell, was takes us back to the Alexander romance, to the grandiose dreams and processions of Ptolemy Philadelphos. No, that's not him. Bingo. To Cleopatra's suicide after Actium, interpreted rather differently in the 19th century. And the Arian and Monophysite heresies, and so on. Alexandria has always had a mythic quality about it. Cavafy, among other things, the poet of homosexual nostalgia, days of 1896 and so on, he reached back into the city's Hellenistic and Byzantine past for imagery, for examples, sophists and soldiers, political lies, dynastic fantasies, moments of memorable defeat, and always, unchanging down the ages, ephemeral and yet eternal in their agonizing beauty, the young men, successors to Hadrian's Antinous, for whom his heart and body hungered. Though Alexandria had had a reputation for good-looking and available boys almost since its foundation, Herodas, in the early 3rd century BC, mentions them in the same breath as toys, philosophers, and gold, it remains true that Cavafy, like Durrell after him, like André Gide in Algeria, was, in effect, shamelessly using another country as a name for his own obsessions. That habit has not been restricted to poets and novelists. Another factor encouraging mythicization has always been Alexandria's more than symbolic separation from Egypt. Both in the Hellenistic and in the Roman period, it was officially known as Alexandria by Egypt, not seldom as Alexandria in Egypt, tucked away on the coast, away from the main entry of the Nile. And that was appropriate in more than one sense. It distinguished the royal foundation of the Greco-Macedonian ruling elite from the old Pharaonic capital of Memphis. It enshrined the concept of a government that regarded Egypt as alien Spear One territory fit for economic exploitation. It rubbed in the fact that no Ptolemy, until the last representative of the dynasty, Cleopatra VII, ever bothered to learn Egyptian, preferring to operate through a corps of Greek-speaking Egyptian interpreters. Seers at its foundation had prophesied accurately that the city would be a melting pot of all nations. Perhaps what Durrell's Nassim meant when he characterized Alexandria as the great winepress of love. And this was to remain true throughout Alexandria's long and colorful history, except that the nations never in any important sense included Egypt itself until after the 1956 Suez War. Muhammad Ali was a 19th century Turkish adventurer who operated much in the spirit of the Ptolemies or Alexander's governor Cleomenes, of whom more later. He exploited the fellaheen by buying grain from them at his own price. The whole of Egypt became his private farm. Neither Cavafy nor Durrell, we may note, cultivated Egyptian friends or made any serious attempt to integrate Egyptian realities into their Alexandrian myth. In this, they were simply adhering to an age-old Ptolemaic tradition. The magic of Alexandria, in fact, can be seen from start to finish as the powerful byproduct of a cosmopolitan and, in Graham Greene's sense, seedy colonialism, at once rootless and exploitative, of which the casual pickups celebrated by Herodas or Cavafy, not to mention Durrell's grisly child prostitutes, can serve as an eloquent symbol. Alexandria became the embodiment of Hellenistic culture precisely because it had no national basis. The Cynic philosopher who proclaimed himself a cosmopolitis, a citizen of the world, might well have had the Ptolemaic capital in mind. The scholarship and the editing in the museum, the obsessional search for past literature that characterized the library and at least one monarch, Ptolemy III, Euergetes I, who forfeited his 15-talent deposit so as to keep the official Athenian copies of Aeschylus, Sophocles, and Euripides, which he'd had on loan. The scientific expertise that went into the construction of the Pharos, the great lighthouse that guided night travelers through the, through the shoals and reefs outside Alexandria's main harbour, the medical pioneering work of an Erasistratos or a Herophilos that depended on royal protection against current religious prejudice to allow human dissection and vivisection, the literary activities of a Callimachus or a Theocritus, blissfully innocent of any influence from native Egyptian literature. All these things were imported, imposed, alien. Hybridization, when it came, began in the lower strata of society, a fertile seedbed for exotic superstition and religious syncretism. Thus, the regret sometimes expressed by Romantic Hellenists for the post-1956 demise of the old Alexandria, this has an ironic twist to it, because the nostalgia might well be regarded as akin to that of displaced French pied noir for the opium dens of the Kasbah, and Islam's wary suspicion of the city from the time of its conquest by Amir in AD 640 was no less national than religious in nature. The silting up of harbours and canals can maybe be ascribed in part to ingrained Arab distrust of the sea and of naval warfare. But Forster was surely right, in essence, when he wrote that Amir and his Arabs instinctively shrank from Alexandria. She seemed to them idolatrous and foolish. Though they had no intention of destroying her, they destroyed her as a child might destroy a watch. But it was not until the regime of Gamal Abdel Nasser, the first truly Egyptian ruler of Egypt in 2.5 millennia, that Alexandria was finally integrated into the body politic on which for so long it had existed as an alien and exotic growth. Readers of Kavafi and Darrell may perhaps reflect that this change was, on balance, no bad thing, that exoticism can be bought at too high a price. Those researchers who, like myself, normally react to a myth by wanting to get behind it have a more than usually tough problem on their hands with Alexandria. Not least if they hope, as I do, to clarify the circumstances of the city's original foundation. When we look at our literary evidence, it at once becomes clear that mythification began very early. The Alexander Romance, despite a stratum of valuable early Hellenistic evidence, ascribes Alexander's begetting to the last independent pharaoh, Nectanebo II, cites his correspondence with the Amazons, has him arrive in Egypt after a razzia through Sicily, Italy, and Africa, and describes his exploration of the sea bottom in a magical diving bell. The historian Ammianus Marcellinus, writing in the 4th century AD, has Cleopatra VII responsible for building both the Pharos and the Heptastadion, that is, the 7-furlong causeway linking linking the Pharos to the mainland. In fact, of course, both these buildings antedated her by almost 3 centuries. The earliest detailed description of the city to survive is that by the geographer Strabo, who was in Alexandria from 24 to probably 20 BC, and is thus similarly 300 years out of date. The difference, to take a modern parallel, between the London of Samuel Pepys and the city I know today. By the date of Strabo's visit, the original foundation had already been transformed almost beyond recognition, since Diodorus Siculus, who was there only a few years before Strabo, writes that all subsequent kings of Egypt vied in the city's development. Some adorned it with splendid palaces, some with dockyards and harbour works, others again with various further notable dedications and works of art, to the point where most people reckon it the first or second city of the inhabited world. Now, the normal recourse in such circumstances would be to the so-called hard evidence of papyrology, epigraphy, numismatics, and the archaeological record. But here, Alexandria presents an unusual and indeed frustrating case. Though the city has survived without interruption from antiquity, nevertheless, from the Middle Ages until the advent of Muhammad Ali in 1805, only the western part, in particular the silted-up neck of the former Heptastadion, remained under continuous occupation. As Peter Fraser says, even within living memory, much of the area east of the Great Harbour consisted of sand dunes. That's Peter Fraser's map. Not much use. There we go. Since this was precisely where the interior of the Ptolemaic city was located, it might have been thought that the opportunities for excavation were excellent. Two factors, one man-made, one natural, combined to render such a project all but impossible. The rapid expansion of Alexandria as a port during the 19th century, in particular under Khedive Ismail, not only effectively buried the ancient strata under new buildings, but also in the construction of the Corniche in 1906, created an artificial coastline up to 300 meters in depth. To make things even worse, in many districts, ancient sherds were redeposited in complete confusion on top of later strata. But such frustrating human activities were eclipsed by those of nature. Over the centuries, there has taken place, partly through seismic disturbance, partly through the weight of silt washed down by the Nile, a general subsidence of up to 4 meters. As a result, much of the coastal section of the Ptolemaic city, which as we know included at least some of the royal palaces, now lies under the waters of the Mediterranean, and the on-the-site papyrological evidence that could have told us so much about the capital's functioning has been totally destroyed. Thus, if we want to understand the circumstances of Alexandria's foundation, we find ourselves compelled to re-examine the literary evidence within the framework of various historical factors, strategic, economic, commercial, cultural, even religious. Some of these are perennial, so that surprisingly, we find modern Alexandria shedding light on its ancient counterpart. So let's begin then with the enigmatic founder himself. Alexander III of Macedon, from adolescence on, made a habit of creating or taking over cities and naming them after himself. His first recorded venture of the sort was at the tender age of 16. Appointed regent while his father Philip was campaigning against Byzantium and Perinthos, he dislodged a group of rebellious Thracian tribesmen and established a military outpost, Alexandropolis, to match the Philippopolis his father had set up 2 years previously. Alexander never lacked the competitive spirit. Plutarch credits him with no less than 70 foundations in all, each named Alexandria, and many of them no more than frontier fortresses. Alexandria by Egypt proved by far the most successful. It was also the one in which he seems to have taken the most personal interest. And we may legitimately ask ourselves why. Now, this question forms part of a larger problem. Why did Alexander choose to go to Egypt at all? After the Battle of Issus in September 333, why did he not at once pursue the defeated and disorganized forces of Darius eastward to Babylon? Why instead did he march over 300 miles out of his way, down the coast of the Mediterranean, spend 7 months besieging Tyre, and a long winter in and around the Nile Valley, and not resume his career of conquest until the late April, possibly, of 331. Now, to understand that, we have to appreciate, as Alexander himself undoubtedly did, the dangerous and fluid situation that had developed behind his advance in Asia Minor and the Aegean, and which now seriously threatened his ever-lengthening lines of communication. Since his siege and capture of Miletus in 334, Alexander had operated, except for one small transport squadron, without a fleet. There have been various reasons suggested for this, but the truth of the matter seems to have been that the bulk of the navy was supplied by his reluctant South Greek allies, whom he distrusted so deeply that he actually preferred the risk of rebellion in his rear, not to mention the challenge presented by having to neutralize every key port from the landward side to their continued presence. Worse, the Persians had also decided to carry out an aggressive and highly successful naval campaign in the Aegean, for which they mainly employed the large Phoenician fleet. After Issus, Darius gave this campaign top priority. Miletus and Halicarnassus, the modern Bodrum, were recaptured, while King Agis III of Sparta, already planning a nationalist rebellion, was furnished with gold and no less than 8,000 mercenaries, while the Persian cavalry commander Nabazanes, campaigning in Anatolia, threatened to sever Alexander's landward lines of communication. So in the circumstances, the sea lanes and ports of the eastern Mediterranean assumed enormous strategic importance. Alexander had done what he could to secure them as far as Cilicia. What remained now were Phoenicia and Egypt, on both of which Persia, being herself a non-maritime inland country, habitually drew for her fleet. It should now be immediately apparent why Alexander spent 7 months besieging the great offshore stronghold of Tyre. Tyre's neighbor and rival Sidon, having been reduced savagely by the Persian Artaxerxes Ochus in 345, after an attempted rebellion, welcomed the Macedonians with open arms. But Gaza also gave Alexander trouble, and another 2 months were spent in reducing that. Besides being a spice entrepot at the head of the eastern caravan routes, it could serve as a military fortress guarding the land approaches to Egypt. From Gaza, Alexander made the 130-mile trip down to Pelusium in the eastern delta, the frontier stronghold at the mouth of the Nile. He made that in just under a week. The small fleet he'd retained got there before him. He found it at anchor in harbor. And since Artaxerxes Ochus had earlier, in 343, dealt with Egypt just as bloodily as he had with Sidon, Alexander met with no opposition at Pelusium and was indeed welcomed as a liberator. Both Phoenicia and Egypt were now safely under Macedonian control. Now, Alexander's strategy at this point is clear enough. It would take Darius at least a year to recruit, train, and deploy a new army. Now, since there was nothing Alexander wanted more than another full-scale and, with luck, decisive engagement, he was well content to leave Darius to prepare for this, while he himself dealt with other pressing problems. Now, so far, he'd secured Cilicia and the Phoenician coast, thus safeguarding much of the eastern Mediterranean sea route. But there still remained North Africa. To the west, beyond Cyrene, which is off this map to the left, lay barbarism and Carthage, as someone wrote, about which not much could be done as yet. But Cyrene itself, and particularly the Nile Delta, these had to be made safe. Now, whatever other considerations Alexander had in mind as he marched westward through the desert from Pelusium to Heliopolis, this one was surely prominent. Mazaches, the Persian satrap, whose garrison had been taken from him to fight at Issus, and who was thus virtually defenseless, crossed the river from Memphis and surrendered the city to the Macedonians, together with 800 talents and the royal furniture. In Memphis, according to the romance, Alexander was not only enthroned as pharaoh, but also, on being shown a statue of Nectanebo II, the last Egyptian pharaoh, inscribed with a prophecy that he would come again to rid Egypt of the Persians, declared himself Nectanebo's son. Perhaps, if there's any truth in the story, to strengthen his own claim as Egypt's new ruler. At the same time, while duly sacrificing to the Egyptian gods, he also held lavish Greek-style games, both musical and athletic, with top-level competitors imported from the Greek mainland, a nice example of his increasing need, as his career of conquest advanced, to be all things to all men. While in Memphis, perhaps after a tour of inspection through the nearby countryside, he settled the future administration of Egypt in his usual manner, that is, by changing nothing apart from those in charge at the top. Now, what he did next has been the subject of considerable disagreement among historians, ancient and modern alike. Both Quintus Curtius Rufus and Diodorus clearly state that his next act was to pay a visit to the oracular shrine of Ammon in the Siwa Oasis. In particular, they, like Justin, place the foundation of Alexandria after this visit, though it is only the Alexander Romance which develops the post hoc propter hoc argument that Alexander's purpose in visiting the shrine was to discover what site the god favored for his new city, and that Ammon duly responded with an oracle instructing the king to found his famous city across from Proteus's island. Now, on the other hand, both Arrian and Plutarch appear to place the foundation of Alexandria before the visit to Siwa. And we have here what has more often than not been taken, mistakenly, I think, for a fundamental conflict of primary sources. Bradford Wells, in an influential article, argued that the Alexander Romance was right, that no Greek city could be founded without divine approval, and that the evidence of Arrian and Plutarch must therefore be rejected. Previously, as he pointed out, Alexander historians had unhesitantly accepted the Ptolemaic version of Arrian. Now, for a while, Wells's thesis gave rise to a sampliced and misdirected debate between the advocates of before and after. It was Brian Bosworth who looked in the right direction for a solution to this problem. There was no reason, he argued, why Alexander should not have picked on a site first, then have obtained divine approval for it at Siwa, and finally have established an official foundation day on his return. One might also stress the fact that oracular consultants, including would-be colonists, habitually framed their questions in such a way as to solicit approval for a choice that had been already made. With these considerations in mind, we can make our sources yield a fairly consistent and plausible account of what actually happened. From Memphis, Alexander sailed down the Canopic branch of the Nile. He already had in mind the determination to found a new city in the area. It was to be large, well-populated, prosperous, with a good, safe harbor. Arrian, on several occasions, mentions Alexander's motives in founding cities. While he had an eye for a strategically or otherwise advantageous site, his main concern always seems to have been to leave a large and famous memorial of himself, an extension of his quest for glory, for kleos. And this was why every such foundation bore his name, to shed, as it were, a natural luster on it. His other recipe for success was a large population, so that we regularly find him not only directing Greek and Macedonian colonists into his new cities, but forcibly relocating indigenous inhabitants from surrounding areas. This being so, during his voyage, he must at the very least have seriously considered the claims of a famous Greek emporium, already long established on the Canopic branch of the Nile, Naucratis. Naucratis had been a privileged commercial entrepot for the Greeks, at least since the early 6th century, And it's hard to believe that the rich businessmen, who surely went out of their way to entertain the Macedonian conqueror when he reached Naucratis during his tour of inspection, did not also try to sell him the idea of turning Naucratis into the city of his dreams. It is even possible that they, for a brief while, succeeded. Plutarch, in a passage that has elicited surprisingly little comment, records that on the advice of his technical consultants, he had already selected a site, was indeed on the point of measuring it off and enclosing it, when a prophetic dream, of which more in a moment, turned his attention to the offshore island of Pharos. Now, that this earlier site was Naucratis is made even more probable by the fact that one of his advisers, Cleomenes, was himself a native of the city, and almost certainly, as his subsequent career suggests, one of its leading financiers. During the night, then, according to Plutarch, Alexander dreamed that a white-haired and venerable old man stood beside him and declaimed two lines from Homer's Odyssey. "There is an island in the ever-surging main, offshore from Egypt. Pharos is what men call it." Now, the king's religiosity was one of his strongest characteristics. He was very struck by this vision, and so he sailed onto the coast, explored Lake Mareotis, and examined Pharos itself. His first instinct seems to have been to follow his dream to the letter and build a city actually on the island. He was only dissuaded from this plan by the realization that Pharos wasn't nearly big enough for what he had in mind. But then, surveying the long limestone ridge between lake and sea, noting the natural deep water harbor, the protection afforded by Pharos, and the lack of comparable facilities elsewhere along the coast, he decided, Plutarch says, that Homer, quote, was not only extraordinary in other respects, but also a very clever town planner. "At this point," says Arrian, "a longing, a pothos for the work took hold of him, and in his usual impulsive, enthusiastic manner, he began marking out the future city's main features, the site of the agora, the number and location of temples, mostly to Greek gods, but also to Egyptian Isis and Serapis. The Homeric dream may even have taken place during an incubatio in the existing shrine of Serapis at Rakotis. The streets laid out in a right-angled grid pattern and so placed as to catch the cool prevailing breeze, hugely strong ramparts, a massive great royal palace. These features are all specifically attributed to Alexander rather than to his successors. One further feature for which he can safely be given the credit is Alexandria's remarkable system of underground drains, conduits, cisterns, and sewers. This clearly had to be in place right from the beginning. It's referred to by the author of the Alexandrine War, and according to the Alexander Romance, was actually recommended to Alexander by one of his technical advisors. Now, one factor that undoubtedly influenced Alexander as strategist in favor of the site was its striking resemblance to that of Tyre. Again, he found an offshore island capable of controlling access to the mainland, and his original notion of establishing Alexandria on Pharos itself confirms the comparison. That the island was too small to contain the kind of city he had in mind was not the only argument, however, in favor of preferring a site centered on the limestone ridge known as Rakotis. What Alexander had done at Tyre by driving a great causeway from shore to island, others might yet achieve here. So, better to anticipate them. What was more, Alexander at once perceived that the existence of such a causeway, quite apart from its strategic advantages, would greatly improve the docking facilities. From an open roadstead merely sheltered by Pharos, the port of Alexandria would at one stroke acquire major eastern and western harbours, each easily protected against both violent storms from whatever quarter and from attack from the sea. For these reasons, I'm very much inclined to believe that the Heptastadion formed part of Alexander's original plan and was implemented during his lifetime. In a passage much contaminated with later myth, Ammianus picks up one tradition that has the ring of truth about it. The Heptastadion, he reports, was remarkable not only for its size, it was nearly a mile in length, but also for, quote, the scarcely credible speed with which it was built. The kind of speed that amazed those who saw it, and even more those who became its victims, was, of course, one of Alexander's best-known characteristics. That Alexander's purpose in founding Alexandria was at least as much strategic as commercial seems certain. Egypt's remarkable ability, even under the most inept of the Ptolemies, to resist successful invasion by land or sea, testifies in retrospect to the founder's foresight. His acquisition of the Nile Valley guaranteed him almost inexhaustible supplies of grain and other produce. Memphis gave him control of the delta. Pelusium had only limited facilities for the maintenance of a fleet, but with the establishment of a deep water port in Alexandria, at the one point on the Egyptian littoral where this was possible, Alexander clinched his domination over the eastern Mediterranean. Two world wars have amply confirmed the port's crucial importance as a naval base. Alexander's emphasis on the size and strength of the city walls suggests a determination to make his foundation equally invulnerable from the landward side. Now, the site of Rakotis had been used as a defense post in earlier periods. Strabo describes how the pharaohs established a garrison there to keep out foreigners, primarily Greeks, on economic grounds, it's alleged, which sounds like an anachronism from Ptolemaic times, and, quote, gave them as a dwelling place the area known as Rakotis, now that part of the Alexandrian city situated above the dockyards, which was then a village, and the land around the village they gave to herdsmen, who also were able to prevent incursions by outsiders. End of quote. Strabo's evidence is confirmed in some detail by the Alexander Romance, where in a difficult and in places unfortunately corrupt passage, we hear of a dozen small villages surrounding Rakotis itself, which served as their administrative center. Even more intriguing, though extremely hard to evaluate, are the extensive underwater ruins of a huge harbor complex lying to the north and west of Pharos. They could be a millennium older than the foundation of Alexandria, and the most plausible theory identifies them as part of the Minoan thalassocracy centered on Knossos. Pottery deposits suggest, as we might expect, a Greek presence in the area, at least since the mid-7th century. Herodotus and Thucydides both refer to garrison posts in the area, the one in the 6th century, the other in the 5th, and in each case as part of a description of Egypt's general defense system. There is no reason to suppose that Alexander, who had all Homer and a great deal of Euripides by heart, would not also be familiar with the two great exponents of his own themes of conquest and empire. The shape of the original city wall is likened by several of our sources to a chlamys, a Macedonian military cloak, which was formed from a rectangular piece of cloth shaped somewhat like the segment of a circle. A convex lower edge subtended to two straight sides converging on a much narrower top edge, the latter straight or slightly curved. The city's dimensions are also variously reported. Strabo's figures, 30 stades from east to west, but no more than 7 to 8 north to south between Lake Mareotis and the sea, these are probably the most accurate. Strabo also makes it clear that the city boundary stopped short in the west of the suburb known as Necropolis, rather creepily. Here, in which, says Strabo, are many graves and gardens and embalmers' parlors. A similar terminus ad quem is provided by in the east by the cemetery of Chatby. Insofar as the Chlamys image bore any relation to reality, it seems to have envisaged an area roughly rectangular, but narrowing northward as it approached the harbour area. So, if Alexander wanted to obtain divine approval for his foundation, it had first to be defined. And that is the true raison d'etre behind the most famous anecdote concerning his activities at the site. Most of our sources record it, none perceives its relevance. When Alexander had fixed on the site at Rakotis, he strode around, Arrian says, marking out, we're not told how, various features of his new city. But the chalk or lime used for marking ran out and was replaced in this emergency by the barley meal or polenta that formed the troops' and workmen's rations. What they had to say about losing their lunch is not recorded. A vast swarm of seagulls and marsh birds appeared and devoured the barley meal. Alexander, superstitious to a degree, was very alarmed as to what this might portend, but got welcome reassurance from Aristander and his other seers, who declared that the city would abound in wealth and provide sustenance for men of every nation. Now, what has escaped notice about the barley meal anecdote is that in every version of it, what Alexander is marking out is specifically the city's perimeter, its fortifications, its defining boundary walls. That lends great credibility to the generally disregarded comment of Quintus Curtius Rufus, who informs us that the use of barley meal to establish the outer circuit, what a Roman would call the pomerium, of a new city, was a custom of the Macedonians. In any case, what Alexander was doing was making a ritual declaration of intent, at least as much for divine as for human notification. He then offered sacrifice for these actions, and the sacrifice appeared favorable, we're told. At this point, Alexander's lieutenant Hegelicus arrived by sea with welcome news from the Aegean, where the naval campaign was everywhere turning in the Macedonians' favor. And it was now that once again Alexander was seized by a sudden urge, that pothos, to visit the shrine of Zeus Ammon in the Libyan desert. And this urge of his may not have been exclusively religious in nature. Alexander still needed to secure Cyrene in the West. And here, actually, luck was on his side. Before he reached Paraetonium on the coast, the modern Mersamatru, envoys met him from Cyrene, bearing rich gifts and soliciting a treaty of alliance, which he was only too eager to give them. Hogarth argued that Alexander only went to Siwa at all because he now had no need to proceed to Cyrene and felt he might as well make the long march worthwhile. Alexander's religious nature suggests otherwise, but Hogarth is undoubtedly right in his contention that the journey was also strategically motivated. Now, we're only concerned here with two facets of this much-discussed episode. The possibility that one reason for Alexander's foray into the desert was to secure Ammon's blessing on the proposed new city, and a search for evidence establishing the true chronology of both the pilgrimage itself and the city's foundation. The only source claiming that Alexander consulted the oracle regarding his proposed foundation is again provided by the Alexander Romance. Though as an unsupported witness, this text does not inspire confidence, Bradford Wells has offered convincing reasons why, in this case, we should believe what it tells us. As he says, did any Greek individual or community ever found a new city without first consulting an oracle? Anyone in antiquity knew that Alexander must have had divine guidance in founding his named city. The oracle, according to the romance, instructed the king to do so opposite the Isle of Proteus, just as he'd hoped, over which, a typically obscure oracle, over which Ion Plutonios himself presides, turning the boundless world on its five-hilled ridges. Let Alexander make what he could of that. This deity, the romance duly informs us, was none other than Serapis. Though the degree of Alexander's personal involvement in the Serapis cult is much debated, the existence of a Serapium in Rakotis seems certain, and it clearly occupied the same site as the later temple, that is, the southwest part of the city, on the little hill about there, where Pompey's Column, so-called, actually part of the temple itself, still stands. That Alexander received approval for his foundation from Ammon, and that this approval was in some way linked to the cult of Serapis, then seems very probable. Now, the journey to Siwa was marked by two phenomena that enable us to date it with reasonable precision. Heavy rain and a sandstorm produced by the southwest Khamsin winds. Both these are restricted to the winter months. Alexander had arrived in Egypt during the November of 332. He probably consulted the oracle in late December or early January. The Alexander Romance offers an Egyptian date, the 25 TB, for the foundation of Alexandria. Conversion to a Julian date depends on whether the writer of the romance was calculating from the Ptolemaic calendar, which gives us the 7th of April, or from Augustus's Roman calendar, which works out at the 20th of January. Since a few lines earlier, he does equate TB with January, the latter seems more probable, and it fits very well with the climatic evidence. In any case, Alexander left Memphis for Phoenicia, we're told, at the very first sign of spring, and this will certainly have been long before the second week in April. The one true inconsistency in our testimony, which also, by the way, baffled Arrian, who reports it, concerns his route back. Did he return by the same route, thus Aristobulus, followed by Quintus Curtius, or make the shorter but far more dangerous trek across the desert through the Cathara Depression directly to Memphis? The only reason he would have chosen to do the latter would be if he was pressed for time. With a January rather than an April date, he had no such urgency. And he was also undoubtedly eager to see his now divinely sanctioned project underway. And I therefore believe that Aristobulus was right and that he travelled back by way of Paraetonium and the coast road to Rhacotis. In a very brief notice, Diodorus records the sequence of his actions at this point. Quote, King Alexander charged certain of his friends with the building of Alexandria, made all arrangements in Egypt, and set out back for Syria with his army. Who were these friends, and what precisely were the instructions that they received? We read of one called Hipponymos, who, according to the Alexander Romance, advised Alexander on the installation of, yes, a sophisticated underground system of water supply and sewers, the existence of which is confirmed both by later literary evidence and by archaeology. With him are also named Numenius, a stonemason, Craterus of Olynthos, not the Macedonian general, and Cleomenes of Naucratis, described as an engineer, a mechanikos. The first two are otherwise unknown. Cleomenes, on the other hand, together with the architect Dinocrates, whom the romance also mentions, was directly responsible for the implementation and initial development of Alexander's dream city. Justin bluntly states that Cleomenes built Alexandria. If he built it, Dinocrates was responsible for its unusual design. Both of these larger-than-life men are worth a closer look. Alexandria would not have been Alexandria, perhaps might not even have survived without them. Vitruvius, the Roman architectural writer, describes in detail how Dinocrates, armed with letters of introduction, went to get Alexander's patronage. Being impatient at the delay in getting an introduction to the king, Dinocrates hit on a decidedly theatrical scheme. Being a tall, handsome, muscular, well-built man, he stripped off at his lodging house, oiled himself, put on a wreath of poplar leaves, draped a lion's skin over his left shoulder, and marched out, grasping a club, to the tribunal where Alexander was giving judgment. The appearance of this sort of Deutero-Heracles caused a sensation. Alexander, curious, summoned him. The sales pitch was ready. Dinocrates, who had a taste for the kind of public gigantism that afterwards distinguished the Ptolemies, and who clearly shared Disraeli's belief that when flattering royalty you should lay it on with the proverbial trowel, announced a plan to carve Mount Athos into the likeness of Alexander himself, with one hand holding a basin to collect the flow of water, and the other supporting a city of 10,000 inhabitants. Mount Rushmore, make what you can of that. Alexander announced himself pleased with this monstrous piece of vulgarity, but with his usual practical eye for logistics, asked whether the city had an adequate local grain supply. That's the top of Mount Athos during a storm. When he heard that all grain would have to be imported, he killed the plan, but at the same time expressed approval of the concept, and enrolled Dinocrates as a member of his staff, intending to make use of his services. Now, that revealing anecdote tells us a lot, not only about Alexander's architect, but also about Alexander himself and his ideas. Dinocrates then went to Egypt in the king's train and was there commissioned with the planning of Alexandria in the king's name, which suggests that he was given a free hand to improvise during Alexander's absence in the East. Nevertheless, it seems clear that much of the essential planning was done with Alexander's prior approval, and that some of it may be attributable to the king himself. Blanche Brown reminds us of Alexander's interest in siegecraft, in harbor dredging, and drainage schemes. Was he responsible for the underground water supply system? Very probably. We may also detect his hand in the creation of vital canals, one linking the Western Harbour with Lake Mareotis, another some miles in length between Lake Mareotis and the Nile, thus connecting the country's internal and external transport systems. Dinocrates was responsible for the clamis-like shape of the city perimeter and for the orthogonal street system, though it may have been Alexander who insisted that at least the two main axis streets should be like those of Brigham Young's Salt Lake City, a plethron no less than 100 feet in breadth, a most unusual stipulation for that day and age. The Alexander romance, on the other hand, represents both Dinocrates and Cleomenes as dissuading Alexander from creating an overlarge territory or hora for Alexandria, arguing that he would never be able to find enough people to fill it. The king seems to have taken their advice, since the actual territory the romance tells us he agrees on more or less coincides with historical fact. The same source states that he ordered anyone living in this area within 30 miles of the city boundary to move into the city itself, at the same time granting them land and Alexandrian citizenship. Curtius adds that he evacuated some other local towns and filled the new city, quote, with a vast population. Now, Cleomenes of Naucratis is an altogether more formidable figure. It may have been his engineering skills that first led Alexander to enlist his services for the building of Alexandria, but it very soon became apparent that this ambitious Greek's chief qualification was as a tough and highly unscrupulous financier and administrator. His first official appointment was as tax collector for the region east of the Delta, and subsequently for all Egypt and the adjacent part of North Africa. His instructions were to let the nomarchs continue to rule their districts in accordance with long-established tradition, but to extract tribute from them, which they, for their part, were ordered to pay. So successful was he that Alexander soon established him as governor of Egypt, the equivalent of a Persian satrap. In that capacity, he ruled Egypt from Alexandria until 323. After Alexander's death, however, when Ptolemy got Egypt as his own satrapy, Cleomenes was demoted to deputy governor. Ptolemy, son of Lagos, prognathous, hook-nosed, a real bastard, you don't die in your bed in that period by accident. He did. But Ptolemy had no intention of retaining so ambitious and unscrupulous an administrator. He'd demoted him, and that was an open invitation to conspiracy. Rumor had it that Cleomenes was already in secret communication with Ptolemy's rival Perdiccas. So it isn't surprising that almost as soon as Ptolemy arrived in Egypt, he had Cleomenes arrested and executed. inspection of the treasury revealed that his predecessor had managed to amass no less than 8,000 talents during his years of office, the talent being 57.5 pounds weight of pure metal. Now, a great deal of this money had been acquired by manipulating the grain market. Demosthenes, or whoever it was, wrote the speech against Dionysodorus, draws a graphic picture of price-fixing and resale deals by a cartel consisting of men who were all subordinates and confederates of Cleomenes. Further details are provided by the pseudo-Aristotelian Economica, which not only confirms the price-fixing charges, but gives us a glimpse of Cleomenes' other activities. In particular, he was responsible for implementing Alexander's relocation policy, which included the area of Canopus, together with its public market. His dealings with the priests and property owners are instructive. First, he announced he would transfer them, and waited. They then, as he expected, bribed him to leave the market where it was. He accepted, that is, until the building material was ready. Then he returned and demanded a further vast sum, quote, which he said represented the difference to him between having the market near the Pharos and at Canopus. When they told him this was impossible, he transferred them anyway. Readers of the Alexandria Quartet will at once recognize a spiritual ancestor of Memlik Pasha. All the anecdotes concerning Cleomenes exemplify his ingenious ways of extracting money from the unwilling and the unwary. And none of this clearly bothered Alexander, who was quite happy as long as Cleomenes did his job efficiently and remained loyal. The governor, for his part, made sure that Alexander got the lion's share of any profits going. One extract from a letter he wrote the king lists smoked quail and thrushes literally by the thousand. And towards the end of his life, Alexander wrote to Cleomenes, instructing him to erect a shrine to Hephaestion. Of vast size, it says, and unparalleled magnificence, on the island of Pharos. This was after Hephaestion's death. Name it after Hephaestion, and issue a decree obliging business contracts to have Hephaestion's name written into them. Do this, Alexander concluded, and quote, any wrong you have done in the past I will pardon, and in future, however you may err, you will suffer no harm from me. This attitude profoundly shocked the respectable Arian, who characterizes Cleomenes, quite justifiably, as a bad man who had perpetrated many injustices in Egypt, and cannot bring himself, quote again, to approve such a mandate from a great king to a person ruling over so wide an area and so many people. But yet, like him or not, Cleomenes was the man who guided and formed Alexandria through the first crucial decade of the city's existence. And we can be quite sure he left his own idiosyncratic stamp on Alexander's original plans. It seems clear that one of the first things Cleomenes established in Alexandria, just as we might expect considering his commercial instincts, was a functioning mint. His dealings in grain show that right from the start, the new foundation formed a natural entrepot for East-West trade. Series of symbolic pictures here of Alexandria the city crowned with ships' prows, if you can believe that. There she blows. And mercantile requirements suggest that the harbors and docks, and naturally the Heptastadion, had priority when it came to construction work, along with the city walls. And Alexander's palace and the shrine of Serapis, they were similarly features that no prudent governor would neglect. Nevertheless, it's worth emphasizing that at the time of Cleomenes' death, none of the major features that we associate with Alexandria, like the Pharos, or the museum, or the library, or the royal mausoleum, the Sema, none of the, or the more extravagant palaces, they had even been started. The cross formed by the two great central thoroughfares must have been in place, but many smaller streets and alleys were left to evolve at random with very little regard for the orthogonal grid. And that natural deviation from rectilinear consistency may have been responsible in part for the persistent, oh, that is what one of the main central roads looks like now. I mean, it's a sort of target for rubbish. The denigration, this may explain these non-rectilinear streets, may explain the persistent demigration of Mahmud Bey's pioneer work in plotting the remains of the ancient city. Because he, like almost every other scholar since, assumed that the street plan was absolutely regular throughout. The most trenchant criticism came from Hogarth, who excavated briefly in Alexandria in 1895. His chief complaint, apart from generalized sneers at Mahmud Bey's amateur status, incompetence, lack of experience, all that, was that the orientation of streets on Mahmud Bey's map could not be reconciled with that of walls and pavements found by Hogarth himself. Now, since both men believed in a strict axial grid, it's easy to see how this misunderstanding came about. But it was doubly unfortunate in that Hogarth's strictures meant that Mahmud Bey's work was almost completely neglected till very recent times. But recent excavation has, to a surprising degree, vindicated his original plan, which I thought I had somewhere, but no, never mind. We still know very little about early Alexandria in archaeological terms. But what we do know, for instance, that the Canopic Way followed the line of the modern Rue Rosette, today the Sharia Horea, that we owe very largely to Mahmud Bey. Now, if we've succeeded to any degree in rescuing Alexander's Alexandria from myth, this is scarcely due to the eponymous founder himself, whose main contribution was to add some highly potent myths of his own. As Hogarth pithily reminds us, Alexander, quote, stayed in the Nile Valley just about the time that an ordinary tourist spends on a single visit, and he never returned to it except as an embalmed corpse. In death, in other words, he ceased to be a tourist and became a tourist attraction. Ptolemy Sotir devoted the funeral procession and, in effect, hijacked Alexander's remains to Egypt, where they remained on permanent display, rather like Lenin in Red Square, first in a gold coffin, and then, when a later Ptolemy sold that for cash to pay mercenaries, in a replacement of glass or alabaster. Julius Caesar meditated over him. Augustus accidentally broke off a bit of his nose. Caligula stole his breastplate for personal use. Septimius Severus restricted access to the tomb, and you can see why. Caracalla, in an unwontedly generous gesture, took off his own purple toga, his rings and jewels, and placed them on the bier. That was in AD 215. After that, oblivion. The tomb, its occupant, and the palace area generally were probably destroyed about AD 273 during the disturbances of Aurelian's reign. A century later, John Chrysostom is asking, rhetorically, tell me, where is Alexander's tomb? Show me, tell me the day on which it ceased to exist. Well, despite this, as we know, from antiquity to the present day, hopeful fantasists have continued to search for the Macedonian conqueror's last resting place. Alexander's posthumous charisma, which so inhibited his successors that they held council meetings in the presence of his empty throne and regalia, that still retains all its old magnetism. The quest has mostly concentrated on the mosque of the prophet Daniel on Nabi Daniel Street, the presumptive site of the Sema. Despite the archaeologists' flatly negative findings, optimists, mostly amateurs, continue undeterred. My own favorite sighting is one which E.M. Forster records by a dragoman of the Russian consulate, probably a liar, Forster mildly comments, who in 1850 claimed to have seen through a hole in a wooden door, quote, a human body in a sort of glass cage with a diadem on its head and half bowed on a sort of elevation or throne. A quantity of books or papyrus were scattered around. Wishful thinking is a great promoter of visions. We know a little of Alexander's plans for Alexandria. We know virtually nothing of its ultimate importance in his scheme of things had he lived, much less how close a resemblance, if any, the shape that the city finally assumed bore to the vision he had in mind as he strode about the site at Rakotis, architects and aides scrambling behind him, dribbling trails of barley meal over dark soil and limestone outcroppings. Victor Ehrenberg's romantic assumption that Alexander planned to make Alexandria by Egypt the capital of his empire is completely unsupported by evidence and unlikely in the extreme. The capital, as has often been said, was wherever Alexander happened to be, his notion of imperial rule being, you might say, dynamic rather than static. Even Fraser's claim that he continued to take an interest in the city until he died rests on nothing more than the king's request for that outsized monument to Hephaestion and his awareness of Cleomenes' financial peccadilloes. Alexander never saw Alexandria in his lifetime, even though he became the city's resident daimon once he was dead. Suppose he'd miraculously come back to see what had been done in his name. Would he have approved what he found? Well, the city indeed did become large and populous, though with a ribald cosmopolitanism that might have disconcerted him, since his notions of fusion always left Macedonians firmly in charge. On that score, the Ptolemaic court and the Alexandrian bureaucracy, while allaying his fears, would also have aroused his Puritan antipathy to luxury and self-indulgence. The harbours, docks, canals and city walls probably turned out much as he'd envisaged them. The pharos would have pleased his taste for practical science while also appealing to his sense of gigantism. Aristotle's pupil, who had taken endless geographers, botanists and historians with him on his conquest of the East, can hardly have failed to approve of the museum and library, though the backbiting antics of its resident faculty would no more have appealed to him than they did to Timon of Phlius, the poet who wrote, in, quote, in the polyglot land of Egypt, many now find pasturage as endowed scribblers, endlessly quarrelling in the muses' birdcage. Plus ça change. Where I suspect he would have felt most alien from the Alexandria of later myth is in the solipsistic sexual phantasmagoria that proved so potent a stimulus to Forster, Cavafy and Durrell, or for the matter of that, to Callimachus. Despite Hephaestion, whom Cavafy for one would have dismissed as the most stunning of square bores, despite the Persian eunuch Bagoas, so tantalizingly romanticized by Mary Renault, Alexander would surely have found the great winepress of love, not least its two seductive dregs, both repellent and terrifying. In a moment of unguarded candor, he once declared that he was never so conscious of his own mortality as when asleep or in the act of sex. Offered two beautiful boys, he asked the donor what shameful quality he had perceived in his king that he should make such foul proposals. Soldiers guilty of rape, he ordered put to death as wild beasts born for the destruction of mankind. Persian women, he described as irritants to the eyes. So much for Justine, Durrell's child prostitutes, and the seedier denizens of Cavafy's Rulepsius. Perhaps, had Alexander lived, the city he founded at the crossroads of East and West might have assumed a different character. Perhaps, but at heart, I doubt it. The melting pot of all nations proved as mythically durable as its founder, and the things it produced got mythicized too. That is a Fortnum and Mason recreation of the Pharos, believe it or not. Ah, yes, we have to come back to her. Cleopatra the VII, a figure whose brilliance and charisma matched Alexander's own and generated at least as many myths. Only by turning back to Egypt could the multiracial spell be broken, and for that the city had to wait over 2 millennia. Thank you.
As usual, there's a chance to ask questions of our speaker. I should say that the funding for Professor Green's visit came from Pharos, the Canadian Hellenic Cultural Society that sponsored his talks in Vancouver. And you're all invited again to the Hellenic Community Center at 4500 Arbutus on Monday night at 8 to hear him speak on another subject, on Pan-Hellenism in a changing world, the metamorphosis of the barbarian. But now, if you would like to ask any questions of our speaker, he's at your disposal.
Very interesting. When he left, he took roughly 11,000 with him, of which about 2,000 were cavalry. He left as big a force in the Greek mainland with Antipater to hold down the Greek states. One of the very interesting things is, you know, how he resupplied himself with troops. Then one of my old students called Don Engels wrote a marvelous book about all this called The Logistics of the Macedonian Army. He does everything from the mechanics of recruiting, which is fascinating, and the replacement, to foraging, you know, how much the animals ate and everything. And incidentally, when he first hit Asia Minor, he only had pay for about 3 weeks and supplies for a month. It was one of the reasons why he had absolutely to force a battle at the Granicus and get a little booty to keep him going.
Another question over here.
Alexander went to the Argos quite often. I presume Darius did too. What do we know about these Argos? Did they have a good track record, or why did people keep going to them?
Oh, Lordy.
Could you repeat the questions if you put the back in here?
Yeah. This is about oracles. Why did people go to them? And what sort of track record did they have? This is a lovely question. It's an enormous one. I'm thinking chiefly of Delphi in the first instance, which is the obvious one that was consulted not only by Greeks, but also by people abroad. The degree of belief you can judge from the quality of the offerings and the amount of time that the process went on for. It's very interesting. Governments get cynical before individuals do. Delphi is consulted by governments until well into the 4th century BC, but round about the middle of the 4th century, governments give up consulting it, but individuals go on like mad. And in the earlier period, certainly, you get somebody like Croesus, who whacks out money, as if Herodotus is true, and he probably is. I mean, in other words, what Croesus was trying to do was bribe the oracle, and the oracle very firmly, in a sense, gave him what he deserved for trying to bribe it. That is, they took his money, gave him front seats at the festival, and other such trumpery privileges, then told him that having summed up his character, that if he crossed the river Halys, he would destroy a great army. Whoopee, he said, went off and did it, and of course destroyed his own. But no, I mean, I'm fascinated by the whole business of oracles, because what my students were always asking me is, how did they get the answers? And how often did they get the answers right? And the answer is, nobody knows this. I mean, there are a lot of people who will spread what is complete fantasy, though it may even be true, there's no evidence for it, that Delphi had a kind of military intelligence service that got the answers before the people who came to consult could possibly find them. But that people believed in them, I have no doubt at all. Again, historians make the great mistake, I think, take something like the 5th century BC trials for impiety in Athens, the Asebia trials, that go on right through the middle of the 5th century, amid all the sweetness and light. And all the historians say, oh, this was sort of pure, pure political cynicism. But the answer is, you can only use, political cynics can only use something if there's enough people who actually believe in it. If nobody believed in the impiety charges, they wouldn't stick. Somebody believed, all right. In other words, there are always plenty of intelligent cynics, and what they do is exploit a matrix of belief, of which there was plenty around. I'm perfectly sure that Alexander himself firmly believed in the oracles. No doubt about it.
There are no other questions, and I would...
Oh, yes. Use of the phalanx, the infantry phalanx. This is one of the things, one of the many things that Alexander got unacknowledged from Daddy, who'd got it from Epaminondas in Thebes when he was a very young and intelligent hostage there. I take it you're talking about the use that Alexander made of the phalanx and cavalry in combination to do what he called his reserved attack. The trick is, you have a left flank, center, right. You watch the enemy and you reserve, you hold back one flank. And go forward with the other. This almost invariably tempts the opposite force to stretch, to meld with the flank that's held back. And at some point, it's going to thin the ranks, or even open them just enough in the middle. That is what the cavalry is waiting for, punches through in a wedge. And breaks up the they used it at Chaeronea, they used it at the Granicus, they used it at Issus. The one place he couldn't use it was at Gorgomela, because Darius had got wise to him by then and had a front that was nothing but armed cataphracts on horseback. And in a sense, he forced them that time to do it by echeloning back his wings, drawing in an attack on them. He knew those wings could only hold for about 10 minutes or a quarter of an hour. But he drew off the attack just enough to produce the gap again. And I mean, that was Gaugamela was a very hard, a very close run battle. And yes, he always operated with integrated cavalry and infantry. This was something quite new. The average 5th century battle was terribly conventional, a hoplite infantry battle, you know, both sides drawn up, eight ranks in a plane, and, you know, may the best man win. It was like a rugger scrum, very formal. And it was broken up after Epaminondas, who, as far as the military was concerned, was no conventional gentleman, said, "I'm tired of hearing about the invincible Spartan hoplites." So when he went to meet them at Leuctra, instead of the regulation 8, he packed his right wing 30 shields deep and just rolled them up like a steamroller. And after, you know, the in a sense, once you've done that, once the mold has been broken, as it were, then you're never going to go formal again. Well, that's one of the many reasons why after that there's much more emphasis on mobile light infantry, the peltasts.
I'd like to ask Madame Eleni Sourani Potamianou, the consul of Greece, to thank this evening's speaker.
I would like to sincerely thank Professor Green for being so kind and come all the way from Texas to be tonight with us and enlighten us about the very interesting history of Alexandria, a city where numerous Greek communities had been flourishing for more than 23 centuries, a city founded by one of the most beloved unseen heroes for the whole Greek nation. I would like also to thank the Vancouver Institute and Professor Hector Williams for arranging today's lecture, and once again to thank Professor Green for this historic journey.